A beautifully designed Squarespace website is the difference between thinking about photography school and selling your portraits online. It's the difference between giving away those cookies you just made for free and running your cookie empire. A beautifully designed Squarespace website is the difference between having a movie reviewing hobby and a movie reviewing career. Squarespace, because no matter what you're into, a website makes it real. Use offer code THEDIFFERENCE for 30% off every plan. Terms and conditions apply.
Blues and Banter.
Hey, Frank.
Hey, Roman. How's it going?
Busy, busy day, but I'm so happy I'm here and having a beer and going to talk to our guest. Have a nice, relaxing day.
Yeah, so let's talk to our guest. Who do you have here?
Well, g'day, fellas. Todd McGuire from Australia. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. My brew is a little bit different.
Cheers.
I promise you, maybe, it's only coffee. It's only coffee. It is coffee. There's no way I could drink at 8 o'clock in the morning, but I'll enjoy sitting back and watching you fellas and have a nice refreshing beer at the end of the day.
We won't rub it in. But so I know this is we tried to do this before, so I'm glad you made time and we can make it happen now. So thanks for joining us, and we'll kind of talk about a little bit of your background and sort of how you got started. Have you always lived in Australia your whole life?
I have, yeah. I live in Queensland and sort of up in the North Queensland area, the Whitsundays, where the palm trees and the hot weather all year, and yeah, it's beautiful.
So you don't get winter? You don't get snow? Or I mean, not snow, but like...
No. I think I've only seen snow once.
Okay.
But even in our winter, which is all, like, pretty much now, it's still a t-shirt and shorts.
Oh, agree. Yeah, that's on ours.
Right, tell people about... about yourself, your background, and then before we get into the book.
Yeah, I'm 53 years of age. 3 years ago, I retired from the Queensland Police Service as a detective sergeant. And I'd spent 27 years in the police, mainly sort of, doing major and organised serious crime. I was pretty fortunate or unfortunate, I'm not sure yet, to do 2 years of undercover work. And there's a bit of a story behind that as to why I eventually wrote this book that I sort of wanted to talk about today. Mm-hmm. And what it was is I joined the police as a fresh-faced, you know, rookie constable in 96, 97. And I got sent down to the Gold Coast, which is, the glitter strip. It's a party place. It's quite nice. Surf is paradise and there's beaches and, bikinis and, it's a pretty nice place to live. And I'm only 20, 24, 25 and living in the barracks, surfing every day, playing footy. And I thought to myself, life's pretty good, eh? Like, couldn't get much better. Because I was never really thought about joining the cops, but it was just a sliding door moment. And I thought, I'll give it a go. And next thing you know, I'm in and I'm loving it. So I didn't look back. And then I met a girl by the name of Karen. She'd had a previous marriage with a breakup with a 4-year-old son, and sort of things started a bit slow. But as the romance blossomed, it got more and more. And I moved out of the barracks and moved in with her. And I've gone from a single bachelor to putting the Lego away at night. And so it was a bit of a learning curve for me, but it was something that I think that I probably was ready to do and as the next part of my life to start growing up and being a man. And things were going really well. We'd been overseas to holidays and all these sort of things. But it was New Year's Eve on 1999. If everyone can remember, sort of our age group is the Y2K millennial bug, where everyone thought that was going to be the end of the world for everyone. All the clocks are going to be turned back and planes are going to fall out of the sky and everything. And being only 2.5 years into the cops, I still had to do the night shifts on the New Year's Eve, like everyone had to work. So I worked 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. and Karen, my girlfriend, had gone out with some friends and to a nightclub, and I was picking her up in the morning. So I picked her up in the morning, drove her friends home, and I won't sort of go through too much of the day, but at the end of the day, I wake up. After we went to bed, she'd sort of got up out of bed, and it was about lunchtime or just afterwards, and The young fellow was trying to wake me up to say where mummy is. Where's mummy? Walked around the house trying to find her. Went downstairs and she'd taken her life by putting a electrical cord around her neck, and she was hanging from the rafters, and that basically just flipped my world upside down. I didn't handle it. I didn't know what to do with it. I'd sort of grown up in a really sheltered, fun, loving household where, you know, we were cocooned, we were looked after, parents did the best job in the world, and I just wasn't ready and wasn't capable to deal with that sort of trauma. And, you know, there was a few things that happened on the day where, you know, I threw the young fella out of the garage so he didn't see it. And it was a couple of years later when, it was about 6 years later, I went and saw him and spoke to him. And his dad said, you know, the young fella wants to know what happened that day. So I told him as best as I could as an adult to a 10-year-old without giving too much away, but I sort of just reassured him what had happened, and it was true and blah, blah, blah. And the scary part about the end of it was that he said, so why was that big black dog pinning me up against the wall outside when you're in with mummy? And I don't recall a black dog at all. I don't recall anything. And so the weird thing about it is that I've been pondered over it for many years going, what the hell is he talking about? And I've only sort of come to the conclusion now that, you know, it was her black dog that sort of left her body and, you know, protected her son from coming in and seeing. And I sort of say to people now that, you know, if you think that your life is a burden onto people and you shouldn't be here and you don't want to be here, what I think has happened is your black dog gets passed on to your loved ones. So some of the messages that I'm saying to people is, you know, if you think that you're a burden, the pain that's going through your head is going to be put onto your family. So, you know, think twice about it. If you want to put that pain onto them, you know, have a real good think about whether you want to do that or not.
I was just saying, you know, it's you were saying you weren't ready for something like that. I'd imagine.
No.
Most people are not ready to something like that. I can't imagine. And then how did the kid take it?
I'm still really good friends with him. He's 31 now. He's married. He's really settled. But he doesn't recall anything. He's got no vivid memories or flashbacks, but, you know, he's had a tough life, you know, knowing that that's what, you know, the legacy that his mum was. So
yeah,
part of this book was to try and write something where, you know, she was remembered and something good had come out of it. And you know, I didn't want her to be forgotten. So this was one way of doing that. And I think I've done a pretty good job of that. So.
And you telling him gave him a closure.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, he's still not ready to sort of challenge all of that sort of stuff and read the book, but he will eventually.
But you did. There was no indication of issues beforehand. You would have never thought this would have been a possibility.
No, and for many years, I had so much guilt, so blaming myself, especially being although I was only, you know, 2.5 years into the police, I blamed myself and said I should. Yeah, you know, I'm supposed to be trained in this, but I wasn't really. But I should have seen the signs, but I didn't. And part of the healing over the last 25 years is to, you know, just accept it and say, hey, this has got nothing to do with me. And I'll never get the answers. And you just got to put it in a box and say, well, it is what it is. And that's it. You know, sometimes it's actually too hard, just searching for answers that you're never going to find.
Yeah, I think, you know, human nature is always, I could have done something, I should have done better, I wish I would have seen this. And I mean, rarely does someone say, fuck it, I did all I could, sorry. You know, I mean, that's really not the reaction. It's just not what, you know, what a good human would do. So it's naturally, and like you said, you've been trained to some degree to deal with it, but until you deal with it, you only have, you know, a very limited amount of what you can do, because every situation is different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very different when you're cradling your loved one and you can't do anything about it versus people that you don't know, very different. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to detect when someone is going through that and is prepared to take their life. I've talked to some people and who had experienced a loved one or friends that took their lives, and they said, I would have never been able to tell that they're going through something. Like the sign, not all people are transparent in that. Like they, you can see everyone's pain like that. Some people hide that pain by being talkative, being friendly.
A lot of humor. Sometimes a lot of humor.
Not really showing. And yeah, it's especially for someone who was in the force for just over 2 years. Even if you were 3 years, how do you get that training to find those signs? You know, I just don't think most people cannot.
Yeah, I don't think there's any training. The way I look at it is, you know, after a while I was in the police, and a lot of our clients come from really disadvantaged families where there is a lot of trauma, a lot of violence and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, maybe those sort of people who are brought up with it could have dealt with it better than what I did. I don't know. But, all I knew was my coping mechanism was to drown myself in alcohol and drugs and stupid behavior. Mm-hmm. And now this was 2000, so it wasn't too much. You know, there was no internet. There was no information apart from going to a psychologist, and it was all textbook stuff that I didn't understand. So, what I decided to do, because I had sort of, I thought there was, you know, I had the perfect life ready for me, and it was all being taken away from me. I decided to put my hand up and be an undercover cop, because I thought I got nothing to lose. Don't give a shit.
Yeah.
So I within 12 months of the day that it sort of basically happened, I had assumed a new identity of the name of Donnie Wilson. The bosses gave me that and said, that's your name for the next 2 years. You're going to infiltrate organized crime and gangs and syndicates and buy drugs and bring down murderers, and you're going to do what you got to do. I said, yep, and I'm ready and willing to do it. So the next 2 years, I just went from town to town under this alias and befriended people and brought drugs off them and, you know, got them arrested. And what I did was, when I look back now, the way that I went about it was just really reckless and poor. To a certain extent that I don't recall ever feeling it. But now looking at the behavior, I was on a death wish. I was basically trying to get myself killed because, you know, the pain was too much and I just didn't want to deal with it. But what I found over the time was it was easier being this, you know, assumed identity and have some fun with all the crooks and, you know, just be a wild man for 2 years and end up being a really fun 2 years. But then you sort of had to get back to the real world after that. So you think that
the trauma you were dealing with actually helped you conceal and accept that new identity?
Yeah. When I sort of had to be Donnie, you know, I was buying drugs, driving in stolen cars, you know, sitting in watchhouses, sitting in jails, getting confessions and all these certain things. And, you know, it was fun. It was really fun. And then all of a sudden they said, oh, okay, you got a weekend off, go back to your family. And I was like, oh, there's too much drama back there. Todd's got too much to deal with. And I didn't really want to do that. So
right.
I really took this job serious, and I just went, I'm going hard. I'm, you know, I had hair long down, I had goatee down here, got earrings, and people didn't even recognize me. And, you know, I really jumped into it. But, you know, when I look back now, I can't believe that I survived it. I'm just glad that I did, but yeah.
Yeah, when you refer to yourself in a third person from an assumed identity, that's been pretty deep, right? But there's not a switch. It's not like, hey, weekend off, I'll go back to being Todd. It's like diving. You get the bends, right? Or you got a decompression chamber or something. If you raise too quickly out of the water, you gotta take your time. And I can imagine that's pretty difficult to sort of manage.
Yeah.
You know,
Like not only dealing with you know, Karen's death. And then, you know, I thought that was, you know, the reason why I had the PTSD. But starting writing the book, and, you know, one of the first things is, you know, knives, guns against my head. I had a $100,000 hit with the Vietnamese triad out of me because of some heroin deal that went wrong. And all of these things, I just seemed to slip out of them. And, you know, I was in a bikey clubhouse one night and I thought I was dead then one night, but I got out of it again. It was like, how the hell did all this happen? Mm-hmm. And I look at it now and I go, what is all of these things happening in a row where, you know, I was just lucky that I got out of it, where by rights I should never have. But I suppose I'm blessed that that's happened, and I now can write a book, which is, people seem to enjoy. So
you said triads were after you?
Yeah, it was a Vietnamese. I was buying heroin in Brisbane, and it was a very, very long story, but they tried to trick me with one of the sales with plaster of Paris, and it wasn't that, but I didn't get to test it. So I sort of went back in there saying that I liked it, which meant that I sort of fell into their trap.
Mm-hmm.
And it went sort of a bit silly. So I decided to pick up some chairs and start smashing the shop that they're in, and it didn't go down well. So,
these are some of the extreme organized crime. And
yeah, I know. And you know what? Back then I wasn't worried. I didn't care. It was like, I remember thinking to myself at the time, you know, I knew that I was never ever gonna, die by my own hand. It's just not something I ever wanted to do. I still don't ever want to. And I saw the devastation of what happened with Karen. So that was never going to happen. But, you know, when you have that pain and you just can't go away, I sort of had these things in the back of my mind going, well, you know, if I get killed on duty, it's a little bit more noble, isn't it? You know, and there's no embarrassment for the family, and I'll even get a boat named after me, maybe. Yeah. So.
Really?
if
you think about it, I hate to think of it that way, but what you were dealing with maybe saved your life.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
Well, it definitely helped you play a part, because you just didn't give a fuck, right? I mean, you didn't care. So people here's this nutsy guy, kind of. He must be, there's something not right with him, so he fits right in with us.
Yeah, I got accused of being a cop by, you know, bikies, and I said, yeah, I am. Put your hands around your back. You're all under arrest. And they just laughed at me. I said, as if anyone would admit that, you know?
Yeah.
There was times when I went, yeah, I think they would have seen it in my eyes, went, I don't give a fuck, you know?
That's right, yeah.
Mm.
Wow.
I kept on bringing down the, you know, the people that, all the big bosses at the police, you know, were trying to always get these people that couldn't be got. And the very first job I got was a fella who they'd been trying to get for years. And yeah, after 9 months, I finally got him, and it was a really big sort of sting, and it was a big finish. And it was really good. And I'm getting all these pats on the back, and I'm going, I don't give a shit about this. I really don't. Yeah, it was just, that wasn't what I was there for.
Mm-hmm. But after your undercover job, was there a recognition for your accomplishments?
Oh, yeah, I got a couple of plaques. Yeah. I would have been on the wall at home.
I want to send you
up on the wall at home.
I know when you're undercover, nothing can be talked about, you know, awarded or whatever. But I was just wondering, once you're done, was there a better recognition and maybe?
Oh yeah, I got plaques saying, you know, recognition of, you know, my work and all that sort of stuff, and bravery and all that sort of bullshit. So
the lives
it didn't really worry me.
The lives you saved too, that's a reward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I was pretty keen to, you know, I did actually enjoy doing the work, and I felt that I still say it's probably the only thing I've ever been good at, because I actually was good at it. I could really spin some bullshit.
So you could play yourself in the movie?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, you could do that.
Yeah.
So living life now, though, after all this, is there any concern about retribution from anybody you may have implicated or sort of had to deal with in your past? Living now, you got to look over your shoulder all the time or worry about anything?
No, the way that I look at it is that they didn't get me the first time, so they're not going to get me now. So, mm-hmm. And most of the crooks that I, put away or dealt with couldn't read anyway. So,
yeah. Mm. That's the answer, is that right?
I'm just not afraid of anything like mm-hmm. that. Yeah. It just doesn't worry me. No.
Well, you really can't be. Yeah.
No. Doesn't worry me.
When did you decide to write the book? Like, what sparked that idea?
Yeah, I suppose it was like, almost 20 years later, 2020 was when I really sort of hit a downward spiral. There was a few sort of things happening in my life, and that's when I really noticed there was something going on. Like, I was angry. I was a sergeant at work, and I was getting a lot of comments from my boss saying, you're not really talking nice to the staff. You're snappy. You're angry. What's going on? All that sort of stuff. And I really had a good look at it, and I thought about it, and I went, yeah, there is something going on. Because I had thought that I thought I'd run faster than it. I thought I'd got away from it. And I thought I was big, tough and strong, and I'd pushed it down and, I'd beaten it. And I wasn't looking back. But yeah, just a couple of little hurdles, and it just all came down on top of me. And that's why I had a really good look at it and started, getting some treatment and reading things. And what I also noticed was about that time when, looking at social media, podcasts and Instagram and all that sort of stuff, where I started listening to people from around the world that have been through similar trauma, and the feelings and the thoughts and the emotions that these people were saying online was like, wow, that's how I've been feeling. Mm-hmm. But no one around me could understand it because they'd never been through it. So I sort of felt a bit isolated for years. So I just shut up. I didn't say anything. But I also thought that I'd beaten it too. But so I just went, that's what happened years ago. That's what happened years ago. But yeah, it did come back and bite me, and it really stung me for a bit. But one of the things I thought was, I'll write a book. And I'll tell you what, it's done about 90% of the job. I cannot believe how good it feels to write it all down and get it out. And, there were some days where I was just bawling my eyes out. Other days, I just couldn't stop. I just wanted to keep going all night. I got the one copy, it's called The Shitty First Draft. I got that one done in like 6 weeks, 380 pages. And I couldn't stop. Sometimes I wouldn't even stop for lunch. It was like, I'm back in there at 6 o'clock in the morning, finish at 11 o'clock at night. It's like, how good's this? And I've never been I've never really approached anything with that much vigor. And I loved it, absolutely loved it. And it just took this so much weight off my shoulders. I don't know, I can't explain it, but, people with a lot more knowledge than me would be able to explain the cathartic things of journaling or writing things down. So
for the 20 years up until 2020, were you hitting it pretty hard with drugs and alcohol still then? Is that kind of what, okay. I didn't know if you'd stopped previous to that, and then something sort of caught up to you as far as emotionally goes. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I sort of, I went into detective work and started, as detectives do, they work hard, they play hard, and you burn the candles at both ends, and there's a lot going on. You're really busy, but you also, there's a big drinking culture too. So, yeah, I was always leading the charge. So,
I loved it. To put it in perspective with people, it's a complete mind fuck, right? when you're the shit you see, that the hours you got to work, the stuff you got to deal with, it is, there's very, if any, very limited downtime. You don't really have time for yourself. It's always consumes you, right?
Yeah. And I always thought, that the issue was always, seeing my girlfriend the way it was. But reading writing the book, then each one of these instances that I talk about, with a machete against my neck or a gun against my head, or some blokes taking me out the bush to buy guns, and I thought they were going to you know, bury me out there, but all these sort of things. And then being a detective, I can't describe how many gruesome crime scenes I've seen as well.
Right. Yep.
So, yeah, obviously what they call this is complex PTSD, and it comes with a whole new sort of world there where you sort of, yeah, it's something that, it's not just a feeling you have, it's something that sort of you have inside you that you just can't get rid of, and it really shits you. It really shits you because you go, well, I didn't fucking sign up for this crap, you know, but it's something you got to deal with now.
Have you ever reached out to the people you've listened to who dealt with the same issues you have? Have you ever reached out to them and talked to them?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Some of the podcasts I've been on, some of them are doctors or psychologists or whatever. And at the end of it, I say to them, every time I do one of these podcasts, I feel like it's, a therapy session. And are you going to charge me $180? Because for 20 years, I didn't mention her name. I didn't mention undercover. I didn't mention anything. People that I've known for the last 10 years, when I wrote the book, came out, have gone, I didn't know any of this, Todd. I said, well, what would I tell you? You know, it happened 25 years ago. It's not something that I just bring up. So it was good to now sort of open everything up. And I do reach out to these people and, you know, no one has the answer. It's something that, you know, you can never fix 100%, but you can manage it pretty good. And I suppose that's where, you know, when I saw your podcast, I thought, I'm getting a lot of people asking me about, you know, mental health, PTSD, and, you know, what are the bad things for it? What are the good things for it? And, you know, obviously one of the things is, you know, drinking and stuff like that. But what I noticed was, you know, the drinking that I did for a couple of years after Karen's death was purely done in a destructive way, in a dangerous and angry way, to write myself off so I could forget about things. And what I've learned recently is that alcohol does have a place in the world, and as long as you do it in moderation and enjoy it, you know, it's got to be fun, it's got to be social and all those sort of things. So that's what I thought. I said, oh, how are we going to talk about brews and banter with, I've got a coffee, but I usually would have had a beer. But I still think that there is a place for it where blokes can, you know, have a couple of quiet beers and talk about what's going on in their mind. I really do. It's a really good way for blokes to do it, as long as I don't do it after the 20th beer.
Yeah. And being in a company who can say, you know, Frank, that's enough. You had enough. Like, as a friend, I think you had enough to drink. You know, just being in the company, I would recognize that and be like, no, you're good. Like, we don't have to go crazy. We don't have to get shit faced.
But to be fair, that's not happened yet.
Yeah, I think people think that we're constantly drinking and getting shit faced. You know, we drink socially and with guests.
Right.
You know, the beer is really an icebreaker. Mm-hmm. It's just to enjoy it in a good company. And most of our interviews, we're meeting these people for the first time. We don't know them. And some of our guests are super nervous. They've never done this. They're even shaky, you know? And then we'll have a drink and 20 minutes in and they're just having a blast. They're like, yeah, why? I was so nervous. I was losing sleep over this. And now it's like I'm having a good time. And I don't know why I was eating my skull. So, but you're right. In moderation with, you know, control and I think good environment, there's a place for, you know, having a drink with your friends.
And your phrase was enjoy, not destroy.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yes. 100%.
Yeah.
One thing I've also noticed with my book is, you know, I have a book with me or if I tell someone about a book and it could be at a pub. And it's happened a few times where it's become a conversation starter. It's an icebreaker. Mm-hmm. And every time I sort of explain my situation, which is pretty, it's pretty heavy when you're trying to explain it to a couple of other blokes that you may sort of not know that well. But what I've noticed happened is, you know, I hand them the book, have a read of this, have a look at that. And, you know, within 5 or 10 minutes, they're telling me that problems that they've got, and they've got tears rolling down their eyes, and I'm going, there's some power in this book. Holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
I initially wrote it to help myself, but what I'm noticing now is it's actually helping others, which is even better.
Well, even that, there's power in the, you know, you're talking to, you say you have a book, but they didn't sit there and read it right then. So just the fact that you were sharing your story in a tangible, you know, book that they can hold and not read, yeah, but they're still sharing with you their stories is, like you said, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And I've also noticed when especially when you're talking to blokes, I noticed the most that they've opened up is when we're shoulder to shoulder, not face to face. And it's really funny. I try to work it out for ages, going, every time there's a constant sort of denominator there where we're shoulder to shoulder, not looking at each other's eyes. And I don't know about yourselves, but for me, you know, I don't like being so close to a bloke and looking in their eyes. It's a little bit dreamy, isn't it? And I just don't like it. But it also feels like when you're shoulder to shoulder, you're in the same team, instead of being opposing each other. So I sort of, every time I sort of talk to someone now, I try and find a park bench or, you know, we sit at the bar and we shoulder to shoulder or sit in the car. And I find it really does make people open up a lot more than what they would.
I think shoulder to shoulder creates companionship where face to face is like an interrogation. Face to face may be intimidating, where side by side it's, you know, we're pals.
I think you feel more like equals, right? You know, same playing
field.
But the same thing. Where they know the things you've written, where you've opened up and shared things that are private, kind of invites them to that space that they can share as well. And that's how maybe it helps them.
Yeah. I played a lot of rugby league and I was looked upon as a copper and a tough footy player and all that sort of shit. And I've had blokes that I thought are so much better and tougher than me on the footy field come to me and say, that's the ballsiest thing I've ever seen, Todd, the way that you've laid your whole bloody life on the line for this book. And I said, well, there's no other option. There was really no other option. I had hit it and pushed it down that it came back. And I said, it was time just to bear everything and that was it. And I've now sort of found that, you know, we don't need to be emotional wrecks or, you know, be deep every time you speak to someone, but being vulnerable and sort of when you feel you can around the right person, it's actually, you know, it's pretty good, and it shouldn't be looked upon as a bad thing.
Especially
with blokes.
Okay. Yeah, it's okay, right?
It's okay.
Yeah,
it's okay to feel vulnerable.
Yeah,
it's okay to ask for comfort.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, being a in the police and an ex footy player and all these sort of things where they really align together, where, you know, the injuries that you get on a footy field, you know, shouldn't be looked upon as any different to what you get in your brain. So if you see something traumatic, that's a brain injury. That's like snapping your leg in a footy game. You know, you still put the plaster on it, you still get it fixed, you still get all these physios and strengthening afterwards. You know, you should put your hand up if you've seen something traumatic or your brain's just not right. You're not right. You know, put your hand up and say, "Yep, I want to get it fixed." But we don't have that same. There's still that stigma that people are still too scared to put their hand up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's getting better.
Yeah, and it's not until I sort of started this thing as well that I've realized that there's just more and more out there doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's even better that we can just keep doing it. And there's more and more. The more people talk about it, you know, it's going to normalize it. And I'm sort of hoping by, you know, the next generation or two, I'll be lying on my deathbed and smiling going, you know, at least I was part of something really good. Because I think we'll get there.
Social media and thoughts that reach out globally.
Right.
I mean, look at us. You're in Australia, you know.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. And we can have these conversations and pass this message to someone who could be listening and dealt with something or could relate.
Yeah.
or could
I get messages? I reckon I get messages every second day from people. I just wrote your book, Tyler. I just want to say you have no idea how much this has helped me. And then they'll tell a story of what they've been through, and you go, oh, God, that's 10 times worse than me. God. And I said, well, I hope you got something out of it. He said, oh, man, I was laughing one part of the book and then crying the next. And every time I just kept on nodding, going, yes, that's exactly how I felt. That's exactly how I felt. And when you get the acknowledgement and you get, you know, I'm not the weirdo, and it's normal to feel like that once you've gone through a traumatic event, you feel a bit better about yourself.
And everybody's got a story. Every person has a story. It's just, you know, you got to get it out of them, and they got to be willing to share it, you know.
Yeah, I sort of say to the younger fellas and girls, you know, life's not easy, mate. It's not going to be easy. You are going to get a lot of shit thrown at you. There's going to be roller coasters. There's going to be ups and downs. You know, you just got to be prepared for them and work out what your plan is when life throws you a curveball, because it will.
Yeah. And that's the real life. That's not, yeah. You know, that's the reality, not what you read or the movies you watch or the stories you hear. Like that's the real thing. That's the real part of it. I just feel like, I think a younger generation does not have enough exposure to reality or experience. And I feel like they are caught by surprise and have a stronger, more difficult reaction to some of the realistic hardships in life, you know? And how do you prepare for that, right? Maybe one way is to talk about it to someone.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's certainly one way. They are getting a lot more information and knowledge more than what, you know, we would have done at the early 20s, which is something that's benefiting them. But I sort of notice the next generation up from me, my dad and friends and stuff like that, they're men of very few words when I ask them about my book. What'd you think about my book? It was good.
Well, he didn't say it shit, right?
And then, yeah, one of his mates, what'd you think? Yep, good. You know, that's the age group. Like, that's just the generations of how everyone's been growing up and believed. And, you know, my age group in the 50s, we understand that we do need to start talking about it, and we know we have to, but it's still hard. But the, you know, the 20 age group, they're embracing it a bit, and you know, it's still not 100% there, but give it another generation or two, I reckon it'll be in full flight. It'll be really good.
Todd, when you wrote your book and before it was released, what was your thought? Like, it's about to be out there in the world for everyone to read. Like, what did you feel like? What were the emotions were like, knowing that now all the things, experiences you went through, you know, the trauma, the hardship, the recovery, and all these private moments that you just now put it on paper, and it's just going to go out there for people to read about it. How was the emotion?
There was a couple that I distinctly remember just before it was going to be printed. I had my editor over to my house, and I said to her, no, I want to scrap it. I don't want to do it at all. And she said, why is that? And I had a massive imposter syndrome saying, no one is going to want to hear about my fucking shit life, you know? How boring is it? She goes, are you serious? Said, yeah. She goes, not everyone goes in and buys, you know, all these drugs with guns to their heads and all that sort of stuff and go through what you do. I said, really? Well, my friends do, but, you know, they're all, it's undercover like so. She goes, no, it is a very unique story. I went, okay, well, I'll take it, whatever. So she convinced me to go through it, and I'm glad she did. The emotions about, you know, bearing all was like, I think it was part of a midlife crisis as well. I said, I don't give a flying fuck what people think about me anymore. I really don't. 10 years ago, I would have been lying up, looking at the ceiling. I would have been worried about this person, this person, this person. Was it going to affect my promotional aspects in the police? You know, all of these things. Are they going to look at me as weak? Am I now going to have a mental health problem? Are they going to take the gun off me? Are they going to have desk duties? All of these things. So, yeah, I would have been really worried about it back then. But I came to the conclusion that if anyone wants to put shit on me and think I'm weak or weird for doing it, good on them, mate. They're not my people.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was the initial reaction from people, like friends, family?
Your coworkers?
Yeah, something. Like right away, like the book went out, I don't know, a few weeks later or so. What was the initial wave of response?
The response that I got initially, and I'll get the same still. So I released it in February. So it's still fairly brand new, still new. Is the messages that I get from people was, wow, I didn't know you went through that. And two, I haven't read a book in 20 years and I did it in 2 days. I couldn't put it down. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, yeah, I didn't put big words in there. I'm just a old footy player copper that not real smart either. So, yeah.
So
I think apparently it's really easy to read. So
The other side of that, have you had anybody say this is complete junk and yeah, you shouldn't have done
really?
That? Yeah, yeah. So no. Those are what people would normally think. Those are normal thoughts before writing a book. But I don't know that there's really a lot of people that get that sort of feedback. You shouldn't have done it. It's terrible, right?
No, everyone. Yeah, I'm surprised how many people have said that they couldn't put it down. I initially thought it was going to be, my family and friends would buy it and I'd have it, up in the bookshelf at home and, I'd look at it and go, I remember when I did that book. But, yeah, it really has taken off. It's amazing. And, I'm really surprised. But I probably should take more credit, I think.
Yeah,
but I do play it down a bit.
Mm. And in a way,
didn't play it down.
You also couldn't stop writing it. You couldn't stop. You're like 6 to 11, start again, and you couldn't stop writing it. It kind of, that energy is now transferred to the readers where they couldn't put it down,
Yeah. I didn't want it to be all dark and gloomy either. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very strange. There's a lot of funny stories. There's also a lot of sad stories, obviously, and there's a lot of scary stories. But I had so many people say, I was bawling my eyes out in one page, and then 2 pages later, I'm laughing my head off. I couldn't stop laughing. And even my son, he's 20. I got him to read it before it started, and he said two things, Dad. One, how the hell are you still alive? That is amazing. Mm-hmm. And I went, yeah, I know. And secondly, he goes, and I didn't realize you were that funny. And I was like, bullshit. No way. So there's a lot of that, Australian slang and rhyming slang. And it's actually, I've had a few people say, I was laughing for 3 days at this one particular comment. So, I made sure that it was easily read, that you weren't sort of sad the whole time. We're still having a bit of a giggle and we still have to have a laugh in the world, and it's not all doom and gloom.
It's laughter is one of the healing emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I prefer laughter more than
from anything else. I like books that have a range of emotions like that.
The roller coaster. Yeah.
Because it doesn't exhaust you in being too sad all the time. All right, I gotta put this book down. It's tough, but there's something coming. And that curiosity of like, what's next and how I'm going to react, I think it's like keeping the reader glued to the book. I've had that with one of the books I read where it was like this, crying, laughing. Ooh. And I felt the same way. By the time I bought the book at the airport and when I landed, 6 hours later, I was done. But it was walking through the bridge to get on the plane. Like the book was open. I was constantly reading it. and not a big book, but it was that style of writing, of roller coaster of emotions. You kind of want to continue reading, and yeah. As my person, like just my personality and what I like to read, something like that really captures my attention.
Yeah, I'm still trying to work out what genre the book is, whether it's true crime, whether it's, you know, self-help, mental health, well-being, all that sort of stuff, because yeah, it's broken up into three chapters where I talk about my childhood and, you know, playing footy and having a good, great lifestyle, and then basically explaining how one incident can just turn your whole life upside down. And then that becomes chapter two, where, you know, that happens, and then I turn into Donnie, and then I talk about maybe four or five operations that I did, and I sort of go into what I did, and, you know, I don't sort of give too much away about how undercovers do stuff, but I sort of generally talked about, you know, the things that went wrong, which were a few of them. And then chapter three is, you know, leaving undercover and getting back into the real world and having to navigate that, which was tough. And then meeting a new girl and starting a new family and sort of trying to move forward. And then talk about some of the healing and things that I did right, did wrong, mainly all wrong, really.
Mm. Yeah. What's your expectation from, like, what do you expect people to take from your book?
The main message I'm trying to say is you don't run from it like I did. Address it straight up, talk about it, get whatever treatment or therapy you need, you feel is good, but just don't hide from it. Don't numb it by stupid behavior, drugs or alcohol. Just accept that, yeah, shit is going to happen. Shit's going to happen. And all I can say is take it on head first and just, yeah, it's going to be shit.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you, years down the track, it's even worse.
That's right, so yeah.
Try and deal with it now.
Yep. And yeah. Take it on with help, not on your
own. Yeah. 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 And I don't know what the right thing is because for each person, it's different.
Oh, yeah.
For me, talking to counsellors and psychologists didn't really do much. But for other people, it's really good. But being around other people who understand, you know, the emotions of complex PTSD and trauma and stuff is basically where I get my strength from, where I understand, where I get the validation that what I'm thinking is correct and that it's not weird. That's exactly how people think when they're going through that sort of stuff.
Right.
So
Oh, go ahead.
I sort of talk about an analogy where, you know, I tried so many different, you know, therapy sessions, you know, and one of my chapters is beige couches. I hate sitting on beige couches talking to psychologists and stuff. And I'm not here to bag them. I'm just saying that it didn't help me because what I noticed is that, yeah, they're obviously quite educated and skilled and they know all the chemical imbalances and all these things that happens in the body. Mm-hmm. But one thing I noticed is if they didn't have that sixth sense of grief and trauma only through someone who's been through significant stuff and are really struggling, I could see straight through it. It was like, you don't know what I'm talking about. You don't. Mm-hmm. I know you're talking from a textbook saying, yep, well, this is the reasons for it. But I didn't feel like the person could understand me 100%. And I sort of do the analogy of when you speak to someone that, you know, has gone through significant trauma and they feel the same way as me, you pick it up straight away. It's almost like you can pick them up. It's really easy to get.
There's a connection. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just words that they say or things, or it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And when people haven't, and especially if they're a psychologist and they're sort of trying to help you, I say, well, it's like a man telling a woman what to expect in childbirth. It's impossible for us to do that. And that's how I felt if you haven't had you know, someone really close to you die, or you've seen traumatic shit like that, and you're really struggling still, I can't see how I can feel good about myself, you know, spilling my guts to you. I really don't.
Maybe you need both. A therapist who can help you unfold some problems that you didn't see or knew how to reach to them. But then take that and talk to someone who has experienced the same. Connect with and talk about those issues, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to revisit all of that now. And I sort of started looking into, you know, the alternative therapies, and you know, I was going to do a ketamine treatment program, and yeah, there's a few other ones like psilocybin, microdosing. There's a few other ones. That's the mushrooms, mushroom psychedelics. There's a lot of
talking about that, right?
I think absolutely, maybe a little bit. Yep. So is this something under supervision?
Yeah. There's a doctor that would look after it. I'm reading on it. I'm not doing it yet, but I'm reading on it and going, there seems to be some really good studies and results coming out of it. Because I don't know, there's not too many other things to do now. I've pretty much done everything apart from fixing that. But yeah, there's a lot of US vets that are going down to Mexico and doing this ibogaine as well and ayahuasca. It's all this plant medicine stuff, and it's a whole new world, and I didn't even know it existed. So just something that I'm looking into, and who knows?
It's kind of a ancient medicine, right? Like this, before medications were around, a lot of it was used, all the herbs and mushrooms.
From what I can gather, it resets the brain and gets you, back thinking correctly again, and instead of, the injury is probably still making you think not straight. So I'm no expert, however. No expert there.
We pick at these things and we enjoy to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But it's everyone has different story. Everyone copes differently. I'm sure Frank as well, we like to talk to people who are willing to open up and talk about these things, and maybe causes us to question things in our life. Mm-hmm. You know, I could walk away from this conversation, and then on my way, I might drive home. I can think about some of these things and question things in my life.
Sure.
It was helpful or curious, you know? Definitely curious.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Good.
How can we find your book?
So I have a website. The sales from my website, which I have at home and I do a personal signature, is only sold in Australia. And my website is www.toddmcguire.com.au. But outside of Australia, it's all on your online ones like your Amazons and Kindles. And I'm just booked in a couple of months' time to do a audio book, and I'm going to narrate it. So hopefully I'll get the audio book out very soon too.
I was going to ask, are you going to be the one reading the book or somebody else?
Yeah. I've spoken to a few people, especially over in the US. They go, hey, Todd, you definitely got to read it from that accent, man.
That's what they after that was the movie, right? You're playing the movie.
Some publishers don't want authors to read it. They're asking, you know, an outsider, a professional book reader to read it. But I would always prefer to hear it from an author.
Same. Yeah.
You know, with an accent, with whatever. Just coming from an author, it's kind of unique. And I'm sure there's some authors who are just shy, and I get it.
Yeah, I really struggled being called an author. Because I don't think I could write about stuff that didn't happen to me. It's just like I'm telling the story of my life. And to me, it didn't feel like I was an author. I was just a storyteller and I was putting it on paper. But technically, I am an author.
Do you feel like this is a pathway to more books?
Not at the moment. There is another book in me, but probably give me 5 years or so. Just really promoting this book, going from writing it to getting it put together now to marketing it is a different beast as well. Trying to navigate social media, it's not my bag.
And that's a lot. It's all on you, right?
It's a lot of
work. You're doing the
show.
I'm
not real good at it. So I've got someone overseas to sort of, drive it a bit for me and help.
Good.
Because there's so much to do in that. Instagrams and there's all this world behind it that I didn't know it existed. So.
Yeah. So for people to find you, you got your website. And yep. if you're not wholly comfortable with social media, is there someone else they should reach out to? Or is that on your website?
I've got Facebook, I've got Instagram, I've got TikTok, and all of my podcasts and all of my stories and funny bits are on each one of them. And my Facebook will have the connection to most of them, which will just be Todd McGuire. And then Instagram is...
We'll find it.
Todd_author_Donnie.
Author. Only because Todd McGuire was taken. I get it.
some good stuff on there. This interview will be up on, there'll be some clips and other stuff that, little helpful bits and funny stories, sad stories, good stories.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
We'll do the same. Yeah.
We're going to share this with you and we'll do collaboration on Instagram and we'll share the content as well. So anything else you want to add, Todd?
No, I just feel that my job now is to be one of the many in the world to, get out there and talk about it, make it normal, make it an everyday conversation.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what for. It doesn't always have to be in a mental health forum or whatever. It could be at any time. And and that's obviously what we've done today as well. We've just talked about something totally different that you would have normally talked about, and I don't think there's never a time where you can't talk about mental health and making yourself better and healthier.
Of course.
We appreciate you sharing that with us for sure, and taking the time to go over that and deal with us two idiots.
They didn't say
still
no.
It's still too early for
when you rewatch this.
Cool.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you, Todd, for taking time. We appreciate you, making it available to reschedule. This is powerful and very interesting story.
Absolutely.
Curious to read the book for sure. All the information will be in the description for people to find and locate the book or get in touch with you. Thank you to all the followers, all the listeners. We appreciate you. To all our sponsors, Bullfinch Brewing Company, thank you for the sponsorship, Presidium Logistics, FM Realty Group, and Apex Property Management.
And Hopped Up Network and Drink the Aircraft.
And Drink. Boy, they're building up.
And we hope you want to come back at some point. Maybe we could talk about some progress. If
absolutely.
not 5 years, because it's a
or have another conversation.
There is talk about a movie, so hopefully there'll be some progression there.
Mm, yeah,
there really is. So yeah,
yep. Mm. Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Well, yeah, we'll catch up if you can, even before the books or even before if there is a movie, but even 6 months from now, to see how sales are going, see how things are going. Travel and do some book signings, any kind of other public events, but you're welcome back anytime. You know how to reach us, and definitely we appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Beauty. Thank you for having me on. It's awesome.
Absolutely.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
A beautifully designed Squarespace website is the difference between thinking about photography school and selling your portraits online. It's the difference between giving away those cookies you just made for free and running your cookie empire.
A beautifully designed Squarespace website is the difference between having a movie reviewing hobby and a movie reviewing career. Squarespace, because no matter what you're into, a website makes it real. Use offer code THEDIFFERENCE for 30% off every plan. Terms and conditions apply.